It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. This week, the entire country has been commemorating an event that occurred 150 years ago in Pennsylvania, the sesquicentennial of the Battle of Gettysburg, site of one of the defining battles in our nation's history. It happened from July 1st through July 3rd, 1863. But before the Battle of Gettysburg took place, there was a very real fear in June of 1863, as the Civil War raged on, that Pittsburgh was a possible target of General Robert E. Lee's Army of Northern Virginia. I'm joined now in Studio A by the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette's Len Barkowski, who has written about how Pittsburgh prepared for war as part of the Post-Gazette's Gettysburg 150th Anniversary Series. Len Barkowski, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hey, thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
On June 22nd, 1863, the Daily Pittsburgh Gazette, as it was called back then, reported that President Lincoln was concerned about Pittsburgh because he felt it was more an object of military importance both to the rebels and the country than other potential targets like Harrisburg, for example. What was the source of the Gazette's information, and why was Lincoln so worried about Pittsburgh?
We relied a lot during those days on what were called letters from various places. They were often written by, in the case of Army stories, by soldiers who were serving in the field. In the case of our letters from Washington, a business person who might be traveling to Washington or a political leader who might be traveling there. In this case, on June 18th, a businessman from Pittsburgh had a meeting with the president, a large group of people in the White House. And again, if you saw the movie Lincoln, Lincoln did what he liked to take what he called public opinion baths. So he would meet on a regular basis with members of the public. You go to Washington, you stop by, you can see the president. On this date, finding out that one of his visitors was from Pittsburgh, he talked about the importance of the city. And it was indeed a very important place here at the Forks of the Ohio. We had foundries that made giant cannons, one of which you can see now, a model of it at the Heinz History Center as part of their Civil War exhibit, a so-called Rodman gun.
We talked about that here on the show.
Right. There also were factories that produced all sorts of war materials, and of course we had the Allegheny Arsenal in Lawrenceville, where they made ammunition, where they made material for cavalry, where they made all sorts of equipment that the Confederates would have loved to get their hands on. This was a much bigger, much more important industrial city than, say, Harrisburg or some of the other possible targets. When Lee's army, and again, this was the era before mass communications, maybe just the beginning of mass communications, when Lee's army disappeared somewhere in Pennsylvania.
Was it the intention of the rebels to destroy Pittsburgh?
Again, there were two reports that yes, this was seen as a real goal because they could achieve two purposes. They could buy, using Confederate money, pretty much everything that they didn't have, all this war material, and they could do things like destroy, bring the war home to the North by destroying some of our infrastructure and our ability to make war on them.
And in asking that question, I'm asking not only about the strategic targets, because, for example, as we've seen in subsequent wars, there oftentimes were specific targets that countries would have, and you would try to leave a city standing. You would try to avoid devastating the population. So when I ask that question, I'm asking not only about the strategic targets, but was there also a sense that if we really wreak havoc in a place like Pittsburgh, that we can sort of create this element of terror as well?
I think you've hit on it. I'm not sure I would have called it – I'm not sure I would describe it as terror. But again, they did want to bring the war to the North. And it became clear after a week or two that Lee's army probably was going to stay on the other side of the Allegheny Mountains, those wonderful mountains that both isolated us in the 18th century, but also provided us protection. It was fairly clear that Lee's army was going to stay on that side. But nobody knew through early July where Jeb Stuart's cavalry was going to show up. And there was a real fear, and there probably was a real risk that that Jeb Stuart's cavalry could have shown up coming up the Ohio River Valley and taking from among the wonderful supplies that were available here.
And this instilled no small amount of worry in the Union Army in the United States government, and certainly among officials in Pittsburgh. Who was Jeb Stuart, for people who don't know about him, and why didn't we know where his army, where his cavalry, his fast-moving cavalry was?
You've answered your own question there. Because it was fast-moving cavalry, they could travel, you know, 50 miles in a day, fast-moving horsemen, and they were meant to be both advanced troops. They were meant to provide intelligence. That was one of the criticisms of Stuart, because he was off in the Pennsylvania countryside. He didn't provide sufficient
intelligence. So he stayed away from the cities. Because I was going to say, you may be able to travel swiftly between Harrisburg and Pittsburgh, set land speed records, but somebody's going to see you along the way. So you're saying that he traveled along the countryside. Is that how he went unseen?
That probably was some of it. And again, there, if you cut telegraph lines, there's no way to get information through. Again, it was not 21st century communications. It was with the telegraph, with the railroad. There's the start of kind of modern communications. You know information in a day or two, but it but there was a long period of time where they were not sure what the Confederates were up to, and there was an immediate Pittsburgh response. In June, a General William Brooks was put in charge of the defenses here, and citizens, black and white, joined together to start digging fortifications of all sorts on all the high ground, 30 different locations around the city, in the hopes that if Jeb Stuart's cavalry did show up, or General Lee's entire army did show up, they'd at least be able to hold them off for some period of time and at least get be able to provide the city with some warning that the boys in gray were coming.
It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette's Len Barkowski, and we are talking about the scare in the summer of 1863, June of 1863 to be exact, when Pittsburgh was thought to be a target of the rebels, of the Confederate Army and General Robert E. Lee, as the weeks leading up to Gettysburg were playing out. And there was a very real fear of what the Confederates might do, because they were apparently already occupying some Pennsylvania towns.
It's very strange for all of us alive today when we think of war, perhaps with the exception of the terrible events of 9/11. When we think of war as something that's happening elsewhere. There are bombings in England. There are bombings in Germany. There's war in Asia. Readers of Pittsburgh newspapers in the summer of 1863 would have seen stories about troops moving through the Cumberland Valley. They would have seen stories about the shelling of Carlisle. If you go to Carlisle, you can still see on the courthouse, I think it is, the remains of the damage done by that artillery shelling of you know, our city of Carlisle, Pennsylvania. Mm. We had a headline in the Pittsburgh Gazette about the destruction and damage to Chambersburg. This was a frightening time for people. General Lee wanted to bring the war to the north, and to a great extent, he succeeded.
So what was happening, as the attacks aside, if the Confederate troops were, as it was said, occupying, that meant what? Were they taking over people's homes, taking their land, terrorizing the population? What was going on?
I would not use the term terrorizing. There was, when you read many of these stories, if any war could be called civilized in terms of its treatment of civilians, I think the Civil War could be in many of the locations where it was fought.
And
that the Confederates paid for the things they bought. But again, they were paying for the most part with Confederate currency, which would have value only if the Confederacy lasted. They tried
only
very hard.
Only if you were taking that vacation to Virginia or the Deep South. And I certainly don't doubt your account, but I think I and perhaps others listening to this are having a hard time wrapping our minds around the idea of the Southern soldiers doffing their hats before they entered somebody's. I mean, if they needed supplies, they were going to take what they needed, were they not?
They were indeed. And again, I would be remiss if I didn't talk at least a little bit about a story that my colleague Frank Reeves wrote, which was about the efforts of these Southern soldiers not only to get supplies but also to get labor. This was a very, very frightening time for free blacks and escaped slaves in Pennsylvania who feared, with some reason, that General Lee's troops, if they found them, would send them back further south. And that is indeed what did happen. This was also meant to frighten, as I said, the region's free blacks, and it succeeded. You had people who recognized the importance of fleeing from these Confederate armies. It was a terrible time, and I think you could use the word terror describing what the Confederates' plans were for this state's black citizens.
And I want to talk a little bit as well about the African American community and how it rallied to support the effort to beat back the troops were they to invade Pittsburgh. You mentioned that there were plans, there were trenches being dug, there was fortification being put in place. How many men were involved in this effort?
There were almost 7,000, probably at the height. Joseph Horn, the founder of the department store chain, which operated in Pittsburgh for decades, asked his fellow merchants to close down their stores and send their clerks, send their bookkeepers off to help dig these entrenchments. And some of these were quite large, 100 yards on a side, walls that might be 6 or 8 feet, with a ditch or a trench in front, a moat in front. This was a major operation, and it was to give you some sense of how seriously the city took this. For July 3rd and 4th, 150 years ago, today and tomorrow, they banned the sale of liquor. They closed the bars so that workers would not be stopped, would not delay their work on these fortifications.
Wait, when they closed the bars in Pittsburgh, you know it's serious, especially on the 4th of July. Not much of a celebration was had in 1863 because thousands of men apparently were out digging these fortifications, and there was the idea that they had to be sober, and nobody was going to be partying when this was going on.
The news came through on July 6th, basically, that there had been a great victory, and that
at Gettysburg,
and that it appeared that General Lee was withdrawing south, and that of course meant that the need for fortifications in Pittsburgh had pretty much passed. But these were giant fortifications. These were large fortifications, and many of them were certainly still visible when a local photographer went out and took pictures of them in the 1880s, 1890s. I don't remember the date. And some of them existed well into the 20th century. We have a story in today's Post Gazette, which is also available online, talking with a 93-year-old retired minister named the Reverend John Mark Scott, who remembered playing in these forts when he was a young boy. This was one of the forts on the north side.
Forts that thankfully were never used.
Exactly right. And which with the development of the city exist now, either do not exist in memory, or exist maybe as a small portion of a wall, which to my eyes, to most people's eyes, would just basically look like a natural fold in the earth.
The African American community had offered its help in this effort to build these fortifications, and as you mentioned, there were thousands involved. The Gazette, interestingly enough, when the African American community offered its help, Pittsburgh was slow to accept it, reportedly.
Yeah.
The Gazette warned that Pittsburgh, in fact, was in danger of falling behind its cross-state rival, Philadelphia, and we know what a rivalry that is because it exists to this day, that Pittsburgh was in danger of falling behind Philadelphia in its racial attitudes. What was happening in Philadelphia.
Oh, they were able to, they had much, I think probably Quaker influence may have played a role there, and strong, really, really strong abolitionist influence in Philadelphia. They were able to raise up two or three companies that participated more fully in the armed forces and in the defense of the city. We were slower here in Pittsburgh. Keep in mind that Pittsburgh in 1863, West Virginia had just been newly created. Prior to that, that was Virginia. We were only 30 miles from the Mason-Dixon line in either direction. And there was a strong Democratic anti-abolitionist feeling here in Pittsburgh. And it was led by the editor of the Pittsburgh Post. The Pittsburgh Post was the anti-Lincoln, anti-abolition newspaper. The Pittsburgh Gazette is the was the Republican newspaper that supported Lincoln and was a strong supporter of abolition. You sometimes think that relations between the editorial pages of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette and the Tribune Review are bad. They're nothing compared to the bad feeling between the editors of the Pittsburgh Post and the editors of the Pittsburgh Gazette.
Makes you wonder how they ever got together.
One of the miracles of the 20th century, I guess.
What were some of the other events that the Daily Pittsburgh Gazette was focusing on during the summer of 1863?
There are some very interesting stories, some of which have been completely forgotten. One that I suspect may not have been written about since the original story in 1863 was when a man named J. Wesley Green, who was a workman here, he did something called Japanning. Which was the creation of lacquer objects for the home, claimed to have had a meeting with Jefferson Davis in Richmond, and then he took peace proposals back to President Lincoln. And again, it was much easier to get into the White House then than
now. I'm
going to
say this sounds a little fishy.
It sounded a little fishy to the editor of the Daily Gazette. He looked into the background of J. Wesley Green, found out he had had several ex-wives. He had been excommunicated from his church. And most importantly, the newspaper pointed out, according to his boss, he had been here at work in Pittsburgh when supposedly he was meeting with Jeff Davis in Washington. That I just like that story. That's one of the things I like about going into our archives. We've been here since 1786. We're older than the county itself. We're older than the University of Pittsburgh. When I go out and speak to groups, the thing I tell them is that for the Daily Gazette, George Washington's inauguration was a breaking news story. That's how long we've been reporting these both important and quirky stories about what's been happening in Pittsburgh.
Before we wrap up, there was one story that is true that I wanted to get into, and that was about the son of a Pittsburgh newspaper editor taken prisoner during the Civil War, and finding out some pretty important information.
Yeah, the North believed firmly that so often the case that all it was going to take was one push and the South would collapse. What this young man learned after he was taken prisoner and then given a train ride through much of the South from camp to camp, from prison to prison, was that despite the material deprivation that many of the Southerners were facing, their morale remained high. And they remained committed to the idea of the war and continuing to fight for, depending on your viewpoint, their independence or for the breakup of the Union.
Pittsburgh Post-Gazette writer Len Barkowski has been our guest, and he has written about how Pittsburgh prepared for war as part of the Post-Gazette's Gettysburg 150th anniversary series. Len Barkowski, thank you so much for coming in, stopping in, and sharing your insights with us, and also congratulations to you and all of the folks at the Post-Gazette on your very fine work covering this Gettysburg sesquicentennial.
Thanks. It has been very much a team effort, and we've had some great people working on it. And that material is now going to be available, our first time ever, an ebook called The Hinge of History, Gettysburg 150 Years Later. And that's going to be available through the Post-Gazette store, postgazette.com/store.
And we'll have links to some of your work at our website at WESA.FM.
Thanks very much.
You bet. Thank you. Coming up, we'll hear about some little-known but nevertheless fascinating Pennsylvanians involved in the Civil War. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.